You can help support the channel by heading to our merchandise store and picking up some of our great aircraft designs created by our graphic designer. We have everything from fighters to transport aircraft, which you can choose to have printed on t-shirts, mugs, stickers, and much, much more. Head to the description below and click the links and pick up your design today. Thank you and enjoy. John, when did you become interested in aviation?
Really early. I was that sad kid at primary school. So probably about 6 or 7 when I started to get really interested in airplanes. I think by about the time I was 8, I decided I wanted to be a fighter pilot. And growing up in the 70s, of course, there were all these comics, war-themed comics, Battle of Britain stuff, things like that. I'd spend my money every Saturday on an Airfix kit, take it home, have lots of fun putting it together. All the films that were being shown at that time on Saturday nights, and I was just hoovering up all this stuff, and I was quite driven and probably pretty boring at school. So 11, I was lucky. I passed my 11 plus. I left the local village school, went to the town grammar school, and there they had a combined cadet force, which I could join at 13. So I was in both sections that we had, the Air Force section and the Army section, which was great fun.
Yeah.
I didn't really so much do marching, but I loved all the shooting and first flew in a Chipmunk, I think, in 79. When it was coming towards my O-levels, and I was 15, the Air Force introduced this scheme, Sixth Form Scholarship. It was the first year. So I sort of thought this could be worth applying for, and I did. So my father signed the forms. I took them down to the person who owned the local village shop where I worked on the milk round, because he was a councillor, and I needed somebody important to sign the form. And amazingly, I was called forward to go down to Biggin Hill, along with lots of other 15, 16-year-olds, all quite nervous, looking uncomfortable, in our jackets, ties, suits, whatever. And we did the whole process. We did the 3 days of officer and aircrew selection. It started pretty much with medical interview, the leadership tests, the aptitude tests. Actually, it did start with the aptitude tests. And there was a large number, and then by lunch, a lot had gone. And by the end of the day, a lot more had gone.
Oh, wow, really?
And suddenly, the numbers were quite reduced. And I think about 65 of us got the letter saying that we'd been awarded a sixth form scholarship. And some of those are friends for life, you know, still in touch. Actually, one of them, Spike, is my vice president at work. So we've known each other since we were 15-year-olds. So that was it. That was great. You know, 2 years, do A-levels, and we knew we sort of had a future in the Air Force. So once we'd done our A-levels, we're called back down to Biggin Hill, and all we had to do then was a medical to make sure we're still good, and an interview. I think some people had a bit of a stern interview because they hadn't worked perhaps as hard as they should have done. And we were all pretty much offered a choice. We could go for a university cadetship, or October, there'd be a place at Cranmore for us. So a load of us who'd got to know each other, we went down to the pub, mulled it over, and we kind of decided that we'd go to Cranwell as 18-year-olds in October. So we're in. So Cranwell, 4 months, going through officer training, which actually kind of quite enjoyed.
Okay.
So I started in end of October, graduated in March, and I had a really good holding post. So a couple of weeks later, I'm off to Wildenrath in Germany, holding with a Phantom Squadron, and Phantoms is kind of where I wanted to go. And a week after that, I'm on a VC-10 and I'm going to Cyprus for 5 weeks where they're doing a gunnery practice camp. You know, I'm 18. I haven't got a clue what's going on,
wow. You
know, and I'm with all these Phantom guys. They're flying 3 or 4 times a day, shooting the banner and then enjoying themselves most evenings. And I'm out there for 5 weeks. So that was quite something, actually, at that stage. And I kind of grew up quite a lot during that period. You know, Cranwell, you're going through the game, but now you're with a proper fighter squadron doing their stuff. So that was inspirational.
So just backtracking a bit here, John, did you always want to become a nav?
Not at all. I always wanted to be a pilot.
Right.
And I was very driven towards that. But funny enough, going through Cranwell, my flight commander, he was a logistician. He said to me one day, he said, you'd be a much better nav than a pilot. And I don't know why, but he just said that. So I went to Linton, and again, our Linton is basically made up of us 18-year-olds, the sixth form scholars, and a few others. And I'm the worst pilot on the course by miles. So by Christmas, I'm out of there. And it's known pretty quickly that I'm going to go to Finningley and do the nav course. which I was actually quite relieved about. I was one of those people who'd open the curtains in the mess, and if it was sunny, it was like, oh, they're going to chop me today. Or if it was foggy, I'd go, oh, it's a stay of execution for another day. But it wasn't much fun. So I then went to Finningley and sort of had to just realign my sights slightly from wanting to be a Phantom pilot to be a Phantom nav. And I really enjoyed Finningley, and having done the academics of pilot training and having about 35 hours behind me, I kind of really stood me in good stead for when I went to Finningley. So I enjoyed the course. I actually found it not too difficult. That sounds bad in a way, but I sort of went through the entire course first time, so that's 14 months. Now, Finningley was quite a different culture to Linton. The pilot training system was hard and the fail rate was really high. It was just that, you know, they thought if you didn't have the aptitude, you were out of there. Fail a trip, refly. Fail another trip, you'd probably be the just chief flying instructor. Fail that, you're gone. Finningley, I think there was a lot more that we can teach you, so there was a lot more recoursing that went on. So my course of 10, only two of us graduated first time, but a lot of the guys actually were recoursed and then sort of caught up later on downstream. So that was Finningley.
Right, so let's talk a bit about your Phantom time, and what was your first frontline squadron? I mean, it must have been great here being a frontline now for the first time.
Well, it was. I mean, on my first trip on the F4 at Coningsby doing the conversion unit, I was just, I was only 20 years old. And the course, the Phantom course was really hard because generally guys had finished Finningley, they then go to Broadie or Chibnall and spend a few months just sandbagging in the back of a Hawk. Okay. There wasn't a formal syllabus. They just go into the ops desk of whichever squadron they were on and going, today I want to fly that trip, and I'd like to fly that trip. And they just fly freebies with the staff. But that would be that stepping stone from flying the Jet Provost 5 at 360 knots to flying in the Hawk, you know, 480 knots plus in a tactical environment, which was superb experience. I didn't get that. They needed three navs immediately to go straight from nav school to the F4 to make up a course. So that was hard. That was a really hard school. The ground school was hard because it was totally different to the Jet Provost. The systems were much more complex, and it's weapons. Now, the guys from Broadie or Chiv, they'd all done that stuff. And like the first lecture on the Sidewinder, and they asked me about the rules of thumb. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what a rule of thumb meant. They're talking about the minimum range, the maximum range. So I'm the thick kid in the corner. So from then, you know, it gets a little bit harder. Actually, with the flying, I'm average until the end, and then I do have quite a struggle, but, you know, hard work and some good instruction I get through. And I go to Treble One Squadron at Lucas. And again, I think it's because when I was really young and I built that airfix kit of the Lightning with the Treble One flash on the nose, and I went to an air show when I was about 10, and my parents sort of said with my pocket money or a bit of money I could buy a squadron badge, and I bought the Treble One badge. It was almost like I was destined to go there. So I was 21 and I was on a Phantom squadron at Lucas, and I was now living the boyhood dream.
Absolutely. And do you have any memorable stories from your time flying the Phantom?
I can give you three. I'll keep them short because they're all quite long. Here's one. I was the 2,081st person to eject from a Phantom.
Wow.
That's a lot of people after a mid-air. That was 5 months off flying. But that's a long story, so I don't think we'll dwell on that right now. Lucas was all about quick reaction alert, and there was a sign going to the station. You know, this is an operational station. Never forget it. So my first day on QRA, I get launched twice. 10 at night, we don't see anything. Land, bacon sandwich, cup of tea is given to us, so get that down, you're going again. So we launch again about 3:30 in the morning, and with my pilot, get two Bear Foxtrot Mod 3s. Now, the gap is going bonkers that night. The sort of UK, Faroes, Iceland gap is going nuts with Soviet activity. There's a pair of bears crossing 30 East about every 2 hours. So the Americans, they had the F-15s at the time at Keflavik. I think it was the 57th Fighter Squadron were there. Their call sign was Slojin. They had 12 Eagles up that night. Slojin 12 was launching. We had our Q1 and Q2, each on a pair of bears. And then coming up from the south were Wadisham. They had two Phantoms launched as well. So this is my first ever day at Q. And then it gets more exciting because the whole of the UK gets fogged out. And they say, British F4s, you're all diverting to Iceland. Kef. And I don't even know where Kef is. So now I've got the map out. The Phantom has no nav kit, really. The Phantom we flew didn't have an inertial nav system. It had a little air position indicator, attack cannon, and the radar. Eventually, we make our way into Keflavik in Iceland. park the jet, put fuel in, do a quick bit of admin, super excited because I've just seen my first Russian aeroplanes.
Wow.
And by 8, we're in the WIF. Now, the WIF is a bar, very famous bar. It was the Eagles bar, full of memorabilia, and all the Eagle pilots have been airborne all night, and 4 British Phantom crews are in there, 8 in the morning, drinking beer and having popcorn for breakfast. So that's another one, and that was just the operational side of Phantom flying in those days.
Yeah, sounds amazing. But how many hours did you get on the Phantom?
Not that many, 627, I think, in the end. I had a propensity for injuring myself. So in my first tour, I lost 9 months of flying time through recovering from various injuries. So I got 627, it could have been 800, but it was a good number. And certainly when I left the jet, I was very comfortable with what I was doing with the aircraft.
So John, then you moved on to the F3. How did this come about?
Well, at the end of it, we're sort of retiring the Phantom FG1 at Lucas. 43 are converted to the F3, Trouble One would be next. So we're all getting posted, and we knew by Jan 1990 where we were going. So a few months before, my boss, Terry Hanlon, called me into the office and said, "You've had a great tour. You can basically go to where you want." So, you know, the offer was Phantoms in Germany, which would have been great, Phantoms in Wadersham or the F3. Now, to be honest, the F2, the F3, it had a painful introduction into service. I think everybody knows that. It's well documented. But it was improving. The radar was now the Z list, so things are getting better. It was going to have to be made to work. It was getting the money, and it was going to get all the good detachments. So to me, that was the future. So I asked if I could go to the F3, and that's what I got. So I was pretty lucky, I think. Again, you know, I sort of got what I wanted.
Did you get any stick from the F4 guys going, "Why are you going for this new jet when you've got a classic here?"
Not really, because it was almost like a sort of two-way split between those who were staying on the Phantom for whatever reason and those of us who wanted to go to the F3.
Right, right. So can you talk us through some of your ground and flying training on the F3?
Yeah, so again, back down to Coningsby. And we'd start with academics. This time I was a bit more wise to academics and what all the ground school involved, more familiar with systems. Obviously the F3 was a lot more computer biased opposed to the steam driven systems of the F4. And the training aids were much better. Synthetic training aids and the air intercept trainer that we used to go and practice our intercepts on, again, was all computer generated as opposed to an old analog system we had with the F4. We're really still talking 70s technology, but it was definitely a step up from technology we had with the F4. So with the course, it's a mixture of ab initios and guys like myself who'd come off the Phantom. I was crewed up with a guy who'd come from an exchange tour flying Hornets in Australia, who actually was the weapons instructor who sorted me out when I was having my sticky patch on the Phantom conversion unit. So that was quite nice. So we were crewed up together. And then our part of the course was abridged. We actually went to Cyprus with the squadron detachment, and my first trip with the F3 was in Cyprus. And very different to the F4. In fact, getting airborne, and I was flying with the boss of the conversion unit, I thought we'd had an engine failure because the cockpit, the noise environment was so quiet. It was so quiet compared to the F4. The layout of all the systems was much better. It doesn't have a bubble canopy, but the radar and displays were in front of you as opposed to the F4, where you're having to pull the radar out, basically looking down in between your knees. So the flying environment was much better. And of course, the first trip was really performance related. So immediately down at low level, I was pretty aware that that's where the F3's environment was. It could turn pretty well down on the deck, and the acceleration was something else.
It was certainly a quick down low.
Yeah, it was quick on the deck, no doubt.
Yeah. So can you talk us through your first frontline squadron, and did you ever conduct DACT? And could you maybe share a few stories from that?
Yeah, so I went to 11 at Leeming. I wanted to go to North Yorkshire. Nick wanted me to go back to Lucas, where he's going to be a flight commander, but I had such a great time at Lucas, I just didn't want to go back. It would never be the same. So I went to Leeming, went to 11 Squadron, which was good because on 11 at the time, we worked off a line. We worked out of a hangar, the jets were parked outside. It was all very nice sort of atmosphere, as opposed to working from the big dispersed hardened aircraft shelters. So general training we'd do with ourselves, practice intercepts. Dissimilar air combat we would do. Deci Mamani was always a good place to go and do that. And I do remember one detachment where we were working with the Dutch F-16s.
Nice.
Now, the Dutch F-16s, Fantastic guys, absolutely great, really, really professional. But they were, we actually had an advantage because they were still working only with rear sector heat-seeking missiles.
Right.
So although we could not turn, no way could we turn with the F-16, the radar was now working pretty well and we had a better weapons system against them in terms of just our missile loadout. So we had a good day, and I remember a Friday we flew a 4v4 and we tried to put up a four-ship where we thought we'd do well against four of them, and actually it was quite rare, but we did come off actually on top for a change, which was really nice. So we were able to celebrate that evening. So that was DACT. What we did do a lot more of actually was low-level affiliation training, I would say. So that was standard. So again, launched two or four jets and would go and work with Harriers, Jags, Tornado GL1s as they'd be then. The Americans were still in town, so A-10s, F-111s. So we do an awful lot of working, and we generally be at about 6,000 feet, just north of here was a common hunting ground over the border country, and working against the guys down at 250 feet. So we do an awful lot of turning and burning right down on the deck against the mud movers, which, funnily enough, is actually quite a bit more hazardous than dissimilar air combat training, I would suggest.
Right.
Yeah. And you see here, we used to fly a lot with the tanks on with this jet behind me and do that with the training. Whereas if we're doing proper DACT, we'd want the jets to be clean to actually, you know, allow the jet to turn as best as it could. Mm-hmm. But because we had to fly for hours, generally out of Lima, we'd have the tanks on. So going to Dechi was generally the best place to go and do DACT.
So how long did you spend before you became an instructor on the F-3?
3 years with 11 Squadron, just a shade under 3 years. And then going to be an instructor pretty much was the natural progression, I think, for me. So I've done a Phantom tour, done an F-3 tour. And of course, with the F-3, a load of us with the experience on the jet would do the conversion training for the new pilots and NAS. So instructing at squadron level. Instructing on the OCU was, I think, the natural path, and I was pretty happy to go there. But once arriving at 56, then we had to go and do a staff workup and to be standardized, because now our instruction had to be spot on, had to be absolutely nailed to go and do that.
So did you enjoy that role as an instructor?
I did, actually. When I went through the Phantom, some of the instructors were great. Some of them, there was still a bit of old school instructing with a bit of, it's logical, I can do it, why can't you?
But yeah.
Which I didn't really find that helpful for me. I was quite underconfident at times, and I thought if ever I go back to an instructing job, I will not be like that. So I think when we were there, we started to introduce more of a coaching mentality as opposed to pure instructing. Things were changing, things were developing. And also we realized that a lot of the guys were instructing as having issues. In a couple of years' time, we could be back on the squadron with them.
Yeah, of course.
And they could be doing our squadron workup back again. Yeah. So yeah, I did enjoy instructing, actually. It's very rewarding getting people through the course.
Yeah, absolutely. John, how did you become the display nav in 1994?
It's quite a long story, really, and it's a tragic story. So, you know, this really part is sort of dedicated to one of my friends, Peabody, Paul Brown, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But 93, arrive on the OCU, and the Aeros has just gone back to the OCU from 25 Squadron, where Archer Neal and Jim Brown have been doing it. So the display crew for 93 is Jerry Gotham and Paul Brown, and it was their first season, and I'd known them sort of vaguely before from just going around the bazaars and being part of the F3 community. So whenever the jet went away, they always needed a spare jet, so I ended up doing quite a lot of the spares. A lot of the time with Jerry Ward, who I think you've met,
yes,
as well.
Yeah.
So we go away and support Goat and PB at Duxford, Waddington, or wherever.
Nice.
Which is great fun. And you had quite a bit of responsibility because you had to work, you had to make sure the jet was prepared by theirs. So if they had an issue with theirs, they'd boot us out and they'd just jump in and then take the spare jet for flying. So that was the sort of the 93 season. 94 was going to be the second season for Jerry and PB. And I was now a fully qualified instructor. I was running staff workup as well at the same time. I had a course going through that I was responsible for. And also thinking about time really to be applying for the qualified weapons instructor course, which was really, I suppose, the next natural career progression. But at the same time, I was still quite keen on maybe 95 going for the display. Anyway, we're looking now at June 94, and we're going down to Lynham for the Lynham Families Day. So Goat and PB are in the jet. Again, it's myself and Jerry are flying the spare, and we do some low-level work just bouncing hawks out in Wales, landing at Lynham, and we park next to each other, the ground crew there. PB gets out of the jet, and he's in a bit of discomfort, and he's sort of rotating his shoulder a bit like this, and sort of, you know, rubbing his chest. And the trip had been quite physical coming down, and he thought he'd just pulled a muscle. And we thought, you know, think nothing of it, really. Sort of knock off for the day. It's Lynham, so clearly it's Herc's. We're in a nice hotel, and we're in the spa attached, and PB's sort of in the hot tub trying to sort of ease this muscle pain that he think he has, while we're sort of laughing at him. Anyway, over the weekend, it gets sort of like a bit more painful, and he flies the Lynham display, and then we go back home on the Monday, again doing low-level stuff, and that's it. The weekend is sort of done. Tuesday, boss gets us into the mass briefing room, and PB had been found collapsed at his home. And this is on the Tuesday. Thursday, he was dead. Now, this really rocked me and quite a few other people. The fighter community, the fastjet community at that time, losing friends was part of the job. Like at Lucas, in 1 year when I was there, we lost five friends. I lost five friends. Three of us were ejected, five were dead. And it was just part and parcel of the job. You know, you'd lose friends in flying accidents. But this was different. And what had happened with PB was he had a bacteria that had settled on his aorta. He had a tiny, tiny microscopic hole, and he was just weeping blood. But that hole got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it was just like a zip going down his aorta. So despite the best surgeons desperately trying to keep him alive, he died. PB was an incredible character. He was young. He was immensely talented. He had his first in physics, Oxbridge, rode for the Air Force. He was engaged to be married, and he was destined, I think, for senior rank in the Air Force. Thoroughly nice guy, and he was gone. So I was asked to organise his memorial service, which I did. Never done that before. So go and see the padre and say, what do we do? So we put a memorial service, you know, together. There's a lot of people going to come to this, clearly. So we hold it in the Battle of Britain Memorial flight. So it's a backdrop. You've got the Lancaster to one side of Spitfire. To the other side, you've got his F3, his display jet, and a lot of people. And then we all go to the bar. While this was going on, I wasn't really aware, but there were conversations happening about what was going to happen with the display. Goat obviously was involved with the boss and headquarters 11 group and the station commander. And Goat said to the boss that he would like the display to continue for PB's memory, but with me. So boss called me into the office and said, this is the situation, would I do it? So, you know, yeah, I would. So that was it. So, you know, get together with Goat, and I'm now frantically trying to really learn about the display as much as I can, and we have to do a workup or a work down. Now, the selection process for display crews is normally pretty thorough. You know, people throw their hat into the ring, they're assessed by the squadron boss, the station commander. Recommendations go down to 11 group with their 5000 series. Now, your 5000 is all of your flying records, your reports, your training records, your check rides, the works. And they scrutinize it, and the display crew is sort of chosen after a fly-off. This didn't happen. I think my 5000 went down to group. They knew me anyway, and it sort of endorsed very, very quickly that I was approved to go into the display. So then we had to do a work down, work up. So it was only five trips. First one at 5,000 feet, quickly stepped down to 1,500 feet, 1,000 feet, and then the last one was at display height, the formal display height. Which I remember really well, because the station commander was in the brief, Andy Williams, group captain Andy Williams. He was a lightning guy, great guy though, very supportive. And at the end of the brief, sort of tapped me and said, if you don't crap yourself when you've got a face full of runway upside down, you're the wrong person for this job. So we go and we do the final sort of checkout. It's fine. And then a few days later, it's the first show that I do, and Cold Rose. And it all happens really, really quickly. So we lose a number of weeks of the display, but then from July, Cold Rose, and then we fly the rest of the season. It must have been strange for Goat. Goat, absolutely brilliant guy, great guy. But, you know, he was a superb friend with PB. They made a great crew. He's lost his nav, and now he's got me. But, you know, we go and do the rest of the display. We keep PB's name on the jet as a tribute, and mine goes on as well. And yeah, it was tough, actually. You know, that period of the memorial service and everything was really quite difficult. But I think we did the right thing with continuing with the display. And we certainly, the feedback we got from the community was, you know, that was the thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So at this stage, did you have any input in the manoeuvres or the actual display routine, or was it all set and that's it?
For this season, it was all very much set. And of course, Goat was super familiar with the display. I was playing catch up very, very, very quickly and learning about all the other stuff that comes with being, you know, the display nav, the social side of it, engaging with the public and everything else. So that was really very, very useful. And at the end of the display, Goat had done his two seasons. Generally, people got two seasons then, but the boss decided that I would be the display nav for 95.
Mm-hmm. Before we get onto all that kind of stuff in for your 95 season, what is the role of a display nav in the F3?
That's a really good question, actually, because obviously you get the smart answers. You get the smart answers like, you're just talking baggage, or you're just adjusting the center of gravity, or you're a waste of fuel. But fundamentally, it's a two-seat aircraft. That's the basic fact. It's a two-seat jet, and a lot of the systems are worked from the back. So you've got to have that person there for the display. So what would we do? Really try and make the job as easy as possible for Goat and then for Matt for the 95 season. You want the pilot to be heads out as much as possible, flying the display or using with the F3 the head-up display. So I'd be doing a lot of the sequencing from the back. In terms of our crew cooperation, we try and keep it as quiet as possible. We had a really quiet cadence. So, for example, brakes off, we have to take off clearance, and I just go speeds building 100, i.e. acceleration check. Mm-hmm. V-stop, that's our critical speed. We'd be airborne. Pilot would go gear. And instead of him looking at the indications, I would now be looking at it myself, traveling, noses up, gears up, flaps, he'd say. I'd be looking over my shoulders, traveling up. This kind of crew system is what we try and work so that the pilot could be heads out as much as possible, and I'm doing a lot of the stuff just with the sequencing. In terms of the sequencing, quietly saying what the next maneuver would be, derry turn, heading, whatever it was. The wind would have a massive effect, would you believe? Even on the fast jet display, the wind was critical. Yeah. So we'd plan with a forecast wind. We'd make all of our adjustments for the headings for each maneuver on that forecast. But as soon as we were airborne, I'd have a look on one of my displays and I'd have a dynamic wind. And if it was different from the forecast, then it was a bit of very quick mental gymnastics, quickly working out all the new headings for each maneuver that we'd go and do. So quietly commenting on each maneuver. Gates was my responsibility, especially for the big vertical maneuvers, and we did do quite a lot of vertical. So the gate heights, you've got to hit those gate heights before you can basically commit your nose down into the next maneuver, else it can be really bad. So make sure the gates were good. If I was not really 100% happy with the rate that we got to those gates, such with the displays we flew, we could actually adjust quite quickly. So instead of coming with like 70 degrees nose down, I could just say 60 degrees nose down just to adjust.
All right.
We never flew to limits and we never got close to limits, but it always just gave us that bit more of a margin.
Yeah.
The other thing that had a profound, I think, impact on me, I was at Lucas when we lost the Phantom display, a practice at Abingdon. I knew the guys, knew them reasonably well, and you know they needed a lot more vertical doing a practice display at Abingdon that they had, and they were both killed. So, you know, we were both incredibly aware of that. Radios, I would look after all the radios. There'd be an amazing amount of chat on some of the display freaks. You couldn't believe it, you know, with the next act. And it's like, be quiet, you know, we're doing our stuff here. And ejection, here we go. The ejection decision was mine, pretty much. It was always pre-briefed. Every briefing was thorough. But give you an idea, I think the numbers were, if we were 90 degrees nose down, 3,200 feet above the ground, we'd blown it. We haven't got enough height now to recover out. Yep. 2,700 feet, I had that 500 feet to pull the handle. So that's not much time, because you're going down at one hell of a rate.
Yeah.
And if you hadn't done it by 2,700 feet, we'd blown it, because now the rate of the descent of the aircraft would outperform the seat. You know, the seat will go out with a downward vector. It's just G, acceleration, everything else.
Wow.
It will not have the time to do the sequencing for the parachute to deploy and for you to hit the ground. You'd still be basically in the seat or in an undeployed parachute.
Think about that. Wow.
We never got close.
No, that's good.
No, we never, ever, ever got close. But ultimately, that was mine. So it was never a, shall we eject? After you. No, after you. It was a, that's mine.
That's your call.
And we talk about it afterwards.
Right, right. So what shows did you actually fly in the 94 season? And did you go to Yeovil, that big air show? I think it was a 50th anniversary of something. I'm not sure exactly what it is.
No, we didn't do Yeovil. We started with Culdrose, St Morgan. I'd have to look at a bit more detail into my logbook. Biggin Hill, did a Biggin Hill, Lucas, Finningley. Finningley was really good fun because it was the last ever Finningley air show.
Yeah.
Lucas was great fun, but happy hour was very good. Saturday night party was jacket and tie. Can't fit jacket and tie in this jet. So all the display guys are now all beating feet down to Finningley to actually enjoy the last ever Finningley. Yeovil, no. We didn't do for that for whatever reason, which was a shame because it would have been nice to meet a lot of the Tomcat guys because we had Tomcat instructors with us on the OCU.
Oh, did you really?
So, yeah, we had the exchange guys from VF 101, the sort of Tomcat rag or conversion unit. So
what was the banter like there? I have to ask. Like maybe
really, they were just absolutely great guys. Awesome pilots, awesome RIOs, radar instructor officers, interception officers. Very, very high quality aviators and good fun socially. And invariably, they would have been in the spare jet if they'd known.
They
would have been for that one and catching up with their Tomcat buddies. And likewise, we had F3 guys who were out there as instructors at Oceana on a Tomcat.
Indeed. So let's go on to the 95 season, because I think we can go into a bit more detail.
Yeah.
So did you get chosen for the display nav in this season, or did you put your name forward for it?
I was already going to put my name forward for it, and I had a chat with Matt Hawkins, about us going together. But after what happened in 94, I was told I was going to keep the seat, and that was it, and group approved. So then there were three pilots who sort of put their hat into the ring to go and fly the 95 season. Then they had to go through the full process of the assessment, the scrutiny of the 5,000, the flying off with the boss and whatever else was involved. And the boss whittled it down to two, Matt and Shenz, both really great mates as well. And superb pilots, really calm individually, socially good fun. Boss calls me in and he says, flown them both and they're both great and I can't really decide, so it's your call.
Okay.
I go, no it's not it's not, this is what you're paid for, this is your decision, you're the boss.
Yeah.
So I kind of threw it back at him and he stroked his tash as he tended to do and he goes, right, I'll go and fly with them again. So he flew with them once more, and again I think it was a super tight decision, but Matt was chosen.
Yeah.
So it was going to be me, myself, and Matt. Now, Shenz, here's the thing. Shenz got like a consolation prize. So as the loser of the fly-off, he got a cockpit in the Battle of Britain Memorial flight.
It's not bad, is it?
Not bad. So Matt got the F3 display. Shenz went to fly Hurricanes and Spitfires. I never actually spoke to Matt and said, how did you feel about that? Did you wish he'd sort of, screwed up one of your maneuvers if you knew that was a consolation prize? But hey-ho, there we go.
Was the display pilot and nav like a prized role? Was everyone going for it? Because I'm sure I'll be putting my name straight away for that.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, it was prized. And I think there were a few people waiting with steel bars around the corner of the office to give my knees a good sort of rap. But equally, there were navs who did not want to do it for various reasons, all equally understandable, because of personal circumstances. If they had a young family, they might not want to be away for 17 weekends a year. It was a big commitment. And frankly, there were a couple who were very honest, said they just didn't want to be looking at the runway from 500 feet upside down, which I
really?
Totally get as well. Yeah, yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Right.
So there were those who passionately wanted to do it, and there were those that definitely didn't want to do it. And then there was a group in the middle who were lukewarm. But I would offer that if you were lukewarm about doing the display, then you probably weren't the right person to go and do it. The next thing is now myself and Matt, we're going to sit down, design our sequence. Now, with the sequence, it was all really driven by the group air staff orders. Big chapter there in aerobatic displays, and there were the approved maneuvers. So we couldn't just make things up.
Oh, really?
It told us what we could do. Derry turns, slow rolls, half horizontals, Cubans, all that kind of stuff. So it's how you linked them, really, that made the difference in the display. I'll talk about it later. We did bring one of our own maneuvers into it, but we basically just linked our display and worked it and sort of tried it in the simulator and then started flying at it at 5,000 feet just to try it out and make adjustments. The other thing was selecting a jet. The jets, believe it or not, they're all a little bit different. So there were three airframes that 56 Squadron provided that were going to be basically good for the season. We had to look at jets that had a good reliability record. We had to look at jets that weren't going to get dragged out in June, July for a major servicing and all that sort of stuff. So having flown the jets and really put them through the paces, Matt chose ZE732, which was the jet's Alfa Sierra. And then it's great, the Queen gives you a jet, you know, for like 17 weekends. And now you've literally got a blank piece of paper with a silhouette on F3 and some coloured pencils.
Nice.
So now you can do the paint scheme, which is great fun. Now, the thing about the F3, it's got a huge fin. And we didn't really want to attract attention to the fin and make it any bigger. So we went for our own paint scheme. We had some ideas and it was sort of like Waldo pepper stripes. If I can pick up a picture, it's probably a good way to describe it.
Yeah, absolutely. Go for it,
John. So that was the scheme. So what we wanted to do was accentuate the dart shape like sort of outline of this aircraft. So we painted the outer bits of the tailerons in red, and then we had these red sort of like Waldo pepper stripes on the wing. And the idea was at 67 wing with the wings fully back, that red would align and show more of a dart-like profile of the aircraft. And we had this on the top and the bottom surface of the wings. We put the 56 checkers on the top of the fin. We wanted a band on the base of the fin as well, but that wasn't allowed because it was by a primary heat exchanger. And they said the heat from that would blister the paint, which is a bit of a, I'm not sure about that. We put a bigger sort of squadron Phoenix onto the fin, and of course we had our names on the jet. The jet went into the paint shop. That was a 3-week job.
Really?
The paint people were magnificent. Wow. Superb. This is a big job, you know, it's extra to their normal stuff. So they had some beers. And then, because I'd worked with him beforehand and he was a bit of a mate, we got in touch with John Dibbs. And this is how we got the photos done. So our EXO on 56, very supportive. We had 3 trips. We went to Valley with the jet, straight out of the paint shop, picked up the Hawk. Andy Gent was the photoship pilot with Dibsy in the back. Weather was horrendous. So we end up over North Yorkshire doing the stuff, drop into Leeming, and then we do another trip after that. And these are the photos. I love these pictures.
I've just noticed the pylons are also red.
Yeah, we kept the pylons on, but we painted them red.
Yeah.
And the reason the pylons were red was before, when it wasn't displaying, this was still a functional OCU jet. So you'd have to put the acquisition round for the Sidewinder on just for training purposes.
Right, got you. Brilliant photos.
I love these pictures.
John Dibbs.
Yeah, I know. And it gave us lots of freebies. It was a really good day out doing these photos.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So John, can you actually tell us in a bit more detail about the workup for the display?
Yeah, sure. Now, we were really lucky because we did most of ours in Akrotiri in Cyprus. At that time, Cyprus normally had a fighter squadron there doing air-to-air gunnery, but we would go with a conversion unit with the students and do certain phases of the course, be it air combat or something like that. So myself and Matt went out there, but we went there really for our display workup. We were doing 3 trips a day, pretty much. But the thing about Cyprus, you've got guaranteed blue skies, unlimited visibility. You are going to be able to fly those 3 trips a day. The issue with Cyprus is the north-south of the runway is covered with aerials. It's an aerial farm for communication systems. So we couldn't step below 1,000 feet because of that.
Right.
And also because of that, we had to display the other side of the runway, which is over the domestic site. It was over the workshops, over the offices, over the married quarters, the school, the messes. So they were getting a lot of noise. The runway was our display line. The datum, purely coincidental, was 84 Squadron with the helicopters. They hated us. And whenever we stepped, because we're doing, say, 3 times a day, the ground crew would get in touch with BFBS radio and just, you know, warn them that it's going to get noisy. So then they'd play a standard song just to give the people an indication that the F3 was about to go and do the display over the top. And it was noisy. We had to go to the school and explain what we're doing. Kids loved it, actually. You know,
like
I know, but, you know, sports matches were interrupted because none of the players could hear the whistle because we were just putting noise down. And in between us, the Red Arrows were there.
Of course.
You know, so they were doing their work up, their work down at the same time. So, yeah. And in between, you know, the jets were just flying with the student flying. So it's a really busy time. So we did about 20 trips in Cyprus, got ourselves comfortably down to 1,000 feet. It was also very good because we had Archie Neal with us. Now, Archie was a flight commander on the OCU at this time. He'd been the display pilot. So he was our coach. He was our mentor. And Archie gave us really good feedback. criticism, always constructive. He was fantastic, you know, made us change a few things. But without him, it would have been harder. And we also had our station commander out there at the time, who we didn't really know, but, you know, sort of bumped around a few times. Yeah. Now, station commander at Coningsby at the time was probably the most intellectually impressive individual I've met in the Air Force.
Really?
Yeah. And he was Mr. F3. He'd been in charge of the evaluation unit. He was a guy driven through so many of the modifications, improvements, intellectually very, very gifted. He also had, you know, a bit of an eccentric character. Those who know him will recognize the fact he'd always be walking around. In one hand, he'd have like a little tea strainer for how he always made his cups of tea. You know, he's very precise and how long he'd squeeze it for. In the other hand, he'd always have a little notebook and a little pencil for whichever subject he'd be discussing of that day. And he had his little aeros notebook. So he'd be there with his cups of tea and his little notebook making notes. And his comments, his observations, they were always incredibly perceptive, very wise, very supportive. And the fact we were with the station commander there for those 3 weeks or so was great, because I think he recognised me and Matt for who we were and how we were taking this season. So there's a lot of trust that was developed, because ultimately, you know, he's responsible to the air officer commanding for us for doing the display. So that was pretty valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. And during the workup, did you have a talk with other fighter crews, you know, maybe the F-16 display guys, and see what they're doing? Because I've heard, like, I don't know if it happened in your day, but where they go to a meeting and they all talk to the fast jet display people. Was that a thing in your time?
It was, but not at that sort of calendar month. We had Archie with us, so it was invaluable. Yeah. Where we did do it was an air display symposium at the end of the season, which was more for the next. And actually, at the end of 95, myself and Matt were invited by Rick Peacock Edwards, who at that time was the Inspector of Flight Safety, to go to, I think it was Cottesmore, and we were invited to give like the fast display sort of lessons learned, recommendations and top tips sort of stuff, with a lot of other display. A lot of stuff was handed down. Corporate knowledge was not lost on the display. So when we started each season, you know, you get the pack up, there were display notes, F3 specific notes, all the notes on each individual display venue. Most soberingly, there was a very thick file of accident reports of accidents involving display flying. So I've already mentioned the Phantom at Abingdon, a Lightning at Scarborough, there was a Bulldog at Southport, Jet Provost at Linton. It was a very thick file of display accidents that we go through.
How many flights or training flights did you actually have before you went for your PDA flight? And can you talk us through that PDA flight? And is there a lot of people involved in that?
Yeah, so we did about 20 in Cyprus. We did about 20 back in the UK. And then everybody felt we were good. And we had to basically have three sequences, the full, the rolling, and the flat, 100% yes. Nailed. So then through really the station commander, AOC 11 group, Air Officer Commanding 11 group, was invited to come and do the sort of public display authorization. Now, the AOC at the time had been my station commander at Lucas, and he'd been the station commander when the Phantom had gone in. He's quite a fearsome character by reputation. He was well known by the entire fighter community. Nervous? Yeah, I think myself and Matt were probably bricking it, to be honest, because we knew he was going to be really precise with his questions. This is going to be quite tough. The weather wasn't great. We had about a week before Mildenhall, so he came up and we were able to fly the rolling and we did the flat. And in terms of who was involved, it was just us and the AOC.
All right.
That was it. Boss wasn't in there, station wasn't in there for the interview and the debriefing. It was just the AOC, me and Matt. Actually, he was pretty relaxed.
Right.
The questions were all pretty well observed. We knew the answers. He was very happy with the rolling. He was very happy with the flat, but he had to see the full. The clock's ticking. So basically, he just said, right, 4 hours notice. That's all I need. If you get a weather window, phone my personal staff officer. I will be up back at Coningsby within 4 hours, and I'll just see the full. And that's what happened. So the Wednesday, get met brief, weather's going to be good. Boss, can you phone up the AOC? And boss strokes his tash and goes, okay, it's done. 4 hours later, the AOC is there. He watches the full. Full goes well. We don't have another re-interview. We've basically endorsed. That's it.
Right.
He is now going to approve us. And he was very candid then about, you know, what had happened at Lucas in, I think it was 88 with the accident. And he was professed he was glad that we didn't sort of have a pure loop in our manoeuvre, one or two other things. And in the end, he just gave us his business card with like his personal mobile number and said, any issues, anything throughout the season, just give me a call. Right. And that was quite reassuring to have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Actually.
I can imagine. Yeah. So you mentioned there an interview. Would he question you on a technical level? So he'd be like, what would you do in this instance if this happened, this happened?
Very much so.
Right.
Yep, yep. He'd want to know all about the parameters. He'd want to know about our contingencies and everything like that. So he wanted to know that we kind of like thought of plan A. We had a plan B and a plan C. Yeah, it was thorough.
Right, right. So can you talk us through some of the manoeuvres through the 95 season? And I always thought, did the F3 have a signature manoeuvre? I always thought it was a fly pass, wings back, straight into the vertical. But if you can talk us through
that. Yeah, I suppose in a way it had two signature manoeuvres, and let's assume we're going to get airborne from the display venue.
Yes, yes.
So airborne, and we're immediately into a min radius turn.
Yes.
As soon as we've got a positive rate of climb, those wings are going down. We're into a pretty steep bank. And I always thought that looked good. You know, the gear's travelling, the flaps are moving. But we're doing that for a specific reason, I think, just to gauge the wind, identify the datum and the display line.
Right.
Milton Hall, the first display, we nearly blew it because the wind was so strong onto the crowd and we were so fired up. The combination of that meant we were pulling quite hard on the second part of the turn to stay inside the crowd line. So I'd certainly say that was a signature manoeuvre, and I totally agree with you that at the end, low, fast, wings back, always impressed the audience. So 600 knots, 0.9, that was the speed.
That's moving.
Never but, exceeded it.
Of course. Did you have a favourite manoeuvre actually in there?
I like the vertical.
You like that one?
We had a lot of vertical, horizontal Cuban. And the one we did, which we did do as myself and Matt, I suppose as ourselves, is we did a quarter clover, but we flew it towards the crowd. So we do a positioning 270 degree turn towards the crowd, pointing right at them.
Yeah.
This was critical. So I would pore over the map as we're doing the display planning for each venue to try and find a pull-up point, a house, or road junction, something.
Uh-huh.
So we had a ground feature that we could identify that was 450 meters away from the display line, or from the public, sorry, from the people.
Uh-huh.
Because if we pulled up too late, we'd be pulling up over the people, and that's like red card, that's really bad.
And what happens if that happened in that instance? Would you be called to land?
Yes, you could be.
Right.
You might get a warning, yellow card, or you might get a red card anytime during a display. Always aware of this.
Yeah.
So we then fly towards the crowd. We then have adjusted that beforehand for the wind, especially if it was, the wind was also pushing us towards the crowd. Pull up into the vertical, turn through 90, pull over the top, and then we'd be exiting along the crowd line.
Yeah.
So lots of vertical. I liked vertical because it was always quite nice to look either over your shoulder or in the mirrors and just see the world getting smaller and smaller and smaller behind you at quite a nice rate of knots.
Yeah.
Displays, maneuvers I didn't really like. Slow roll was horrible. It really
Wasn't
was.
Archie, I think he used to fly that, didn't he?
Archie did it. And it was Archie's coaching that allowed Matt to fly an immaculate slow roll. And, you know, same with Goat. The jet's computer driven, it's computer flown. It does not like you doing a slow roll. It's fighting the pilot's input to do a slow roll, and it's critical not to let the nose drop, else you're going to have to fly out. It's just going to be really messy. So there'd be a little bit of pitch up, just to get that nose above, and then into the slow roll. And it was slow, and you're hanging in your strap, so I'd have my hands up on the canopy a bit like this. And there was once, fittingly, and it had rained really heavily the night before, and the water had got into the canopy, which could sometimes happen. And I just had this moment of fright. I thought my seat was lifting, first of all, but all this water was now coming under negative G, pooling. It was like ectoplasm or something out of Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
And then it just poured in the canopy above me, and I thought, oh. And as soon as we sort of, you know, positive G, went right way up, it's all in my lap, you know, about 2 gallons of water.
That's not good.
Ground crew going, what's going on here? So I didn't really enjoy the slow roll, but it was a good maneuver to fly, and technically probably the hardest, I think, to fly in the F3.
It was definitely one of the noisiest aircraft circuit. I mean, I've heard them so many times, but how did other, I guess, British display teams see you as well? Like, so was there a GR at the moment, a GR1,
yeah,
a Jaguar? I don't know if that was still about. Or...
There's quite a few points there. They're all good points. Let's talk about the noise, first of all. The F3, it's not a dogfighter, so we cannot do the agility of an F-16 Viper. We can't do the square loop of a Hornet. So there's no point trying to replicate those displays. It can go low, fast, it can turn really well, but it can throw a lot of noise into the audience.
Brilliant.
So every time the exhausts were pointed into the crowd line, the burners were in. That was deliberate. That was all part of the display. So even when we come back and do a 67 degree wings back, break into the circuit, same time as the wings are coming forward, the air brakes are sort of going out to slow us down, it's a bit of burner.
Yes.
It just gets the noise. It gets the people out of the burger tent. So the idea is we're going to stop conversation for 10 minutes and we're going to set off all the car alarms.
It's brilliant.
And people love that.
Absolutely.
So that was always good. Other aircraft, yeah, it was a wonderful community to be in. It was very, very friendly, very professional. So from the RAF, I'm not going to say it was rivalry. We all kind of appreciated each other's displays. I mean, the Harrier was being done by Andy Offer, who then went on to the Reds.
Yeah.
Sunday, invariably, we find ourselves with our team and the Harrier team in a sort of curry house at the same place. The Jag was still around. The Buccaneer, I think, had gone in 93, I think, was the last year of the Buccaneer display. The GR1 was being done by Cottesmore, and at the time they called it Black Beauty.
Yes.
They had the black... they had the black GR1, Mike Alton and Wolfie Harland, who's sadly no longer with us. We didn't see very much of the GR1 crew because all the displays were allocated from Headquarters Air Command or Strike Command, and we'd have certain jets at each venue. So they'd rarely put an F3 and a GR at the same venue.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So unless it was like Riyadh or Ayat at the time.
You'd see them probably, we'd be with each other at Riyadh, at Fairford, Warrington, and Cottesmore when we did one at Cottesmore because that was their home. But invariably, if, for example, they were doing Shoreham, we'd be somewhere else. And that's spreading the jets, all the aircraft, around as many displays as possible. But
yeah,
all the displays, I think, were impressive in their own right. You know, you look at a CH-47 and it was an amazing display going, how on earth is that helicopter being flown like that? There was a Herc TAC display at the time. You know, I remember watching it at Biggin Hill, this Herc doing its caisson approach, the really steep approach.
Yeah.
Stop on the sides of a post-it stamp, ramp would go down, the Land Rover would come out with lots of, you know, hooligans in the back, lots of guns and smoke, driving the back, Herc would get airborne. And it was a great Herc display. So all of the displays in their own right, I think, were really very, very good. All of them.
Absolutely.